Professor Rando Balestriero, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and happy to be talking about world models and JEPA and maybe even more things.
Yeah, we're very honored to have you here. And you're currently a visiting researcher at FAIR, at Meta FAIR, right? Which is a division of Meta that we've covered extensively here, both because of the models and the studies aspects and because of the whole structure of it, that it's been undergoing changes, right? And FAIR, of course, stands for Facebook AI Research. And we've spoken here about Segment Anything, Dino, of course, VJEPA, IJEPA, JEPA, and so on. And we've talked a lot about JEPA in the past, but I don't think we could start this conversation any other way than asking you to run through what JEPA is and what it's so fundamentally different between JEPA and the most common, maybe widely known, generative model frameworks that are out there.
Sure. Yeah, so maybe it's going to not be new to everyone since you spoke about VJEPA and IJEPA already, but JEPA stands for Joint Embedding Predictive Architecture. So the framing and naming come from this position paper from Yann a few years ago. You can find on Open Review. But it really hinges on a concept that is decades old in cognitive science, which is that when you try to model the world, you try to predict what's going to happen in a more abstract sense, losing some details about the information you try to understand. And the only way you can do this is by trying to describe the world in the sense of, an embedding space, latent space, where you were able to abstract what's going on. For example, if I tell you, imagine what happens when you drive and you turn left, maybe you can see a little bit, what happens in terms of the wheel, your hands or something, but you don't try to reconstruct the details of the tree around. Maybe you don't even see exactly what the details are around. It's really more about, what's happening at a high level. And so that's what JEPA tries to learn from data. And it's fundamentally different than, let's say, language model or, generative models, because those guys actually need to care about every single detail in the data. So you need to predict what comes in the next frame, for example, from the past. But because you have this reconstruction error, this generative process, you need to really model every single detail in the next frame. And so this includes all the leaves in the tree, all the birds flying around, which in practice means that you will waste a huge amount of compute and flop to model those things that often are not even predictable from the past. So you spend a lot of time to model randomness, and that's not something that will make meaningful features emerge in your model. So that's the fundamental difference, very high level.
And going a little bit deeper in this level that you mentioned, Randall, yes, I understand the concept behind it, but how do you define a problem that you want to solve using JEPA or whatever comes out of JEPA that you didn't need those birds flying out of the tree or something like this? What is noise and what is important?
Yeah, so this is a very, very nice question. That's actually a very active research question because in a sense, you could say, what is easily predictable is what's most interesting. And so that's what I want to focus on and capture first. So you could say, how easy it is to predict this feature is what's useful for my downstream task. And that's what, a lot of the physical law and so on try to recover. You try to see what are the very few, parameters that can parameterize some PDE or whatever, so that you can describe a lot of things that you see in the world very nicely. But then, of course, you could say, what if someone wants to count how many birds you have in this frame, right? Maybe you lost this information. And so that's where there is a lot of research going on to see, what is noise versus what is signal? And in fact, can you find a way to make sure that you don't disregard signal at all? Because maybe you have very hard to predict signal because you have, bad sensory inputs and so on. So this is something that is on the more challenging side. And it's not easy to debug because since it's not a generative model, you cannot just reconstruct and say, look, the birds disappear. So of course you cannot solve this, bird detection task. So the big research question is how to differentiate signal from noise and how to make sure that after training, you indeed captured the signal of interest. This is the main challenge. In practice, though, you can try to visualize this easily because after training, you can still train a generative network on top of your JEPA to visualize what the features are encoding. So it's not a generative model that is used during training to learn, your embedding and your world model. It's just something that is used post-training to visualize and debug what you capture. So you can have this sort of, you know, qualitative debugging tool post-training, but there is nothing right now that you will theoretically say, okay, train with this objective and I can tell you, you will learn all the signals that you want. But in fact, maybe very quickly, you can also reverse this question for generative models as well. So what we found is that in generative models, because of the, let's say, mean squared error or whatever metric you want to reconstruct, you will actually focus a lot on the part of the features that have a high variance. And so this is what is considered signal for those generative models, and that's what they learn first. So if you don't have enough flops or do early stopping and stop training before convergence, you also disregard parts of the input, which is what has low variance in pixel space or, you know, input space. So for generative models, there is also this sort of cutoff of signal versus noise, but it's defined in terms of explained variance in the space that you reconstruct in. And this is also another bias that you cannot control easily. So I would say this is a fundamental problem in general, you know, what do you want to become invariant to and disregard versus what you want to keep? But it's a very interesting question.
And what is normally the output of such a model or such models?
So those JEPA typically will produce a low-dimensional embedding space that is an abstract representation of all the inputs you saw so far. And those embeddings are not necessarily interpretable in the sense that, okay, you know, this is what pixel 1 encodes, this is what pixel 2 encodes, right? There should be some abstraction, hopefully a little bit disentangled and organized in a nice space, and with more levels of abstraction. So if you do some perturbation of the input, the change in the embedding should be very small if it's not something that's useful to solve your prediction task. So going back to this, you know, a bird example, if you learn the right dynamics and you somehow disregarded the birds flying around, because that's not something meaningful for your prediction task, then whether you add birds or not in the input should not change the embeddings that you get at the output, which again is different from generative model, because generative model will need to capture the feature of the birds to be able to, you know, reconstruct and generate.
At this point, listeners of the podcast are very well aware of how a autoregressive transformer-based model is trained and then post-trained and everything. Could I ask you to sort of as well go over what it takes to train JEPA, or what the terms would be to correctly ask this question even?
Oh, yeah. So actually, if you're already familiar with autoregressive prediction, so GPT-style training, it's very, very easy to go to JEPA. So just think as doing autoregression, but instead of doing it in the input space, so given, you know, the past tokens or the past pixel frames, try to predict the next pixel frame. Instead of doing that in this input space, you will do it in the abstract latent space. So you go to layer 3, let's say, or 10, you know, whatever is the depth of your encoder. And then in that space, you will do your next frame prediction. So given the embeddings of frame, let's say 1 to 10, can I predict the embedding of frame 11? So you do this in this abstract, you know, embedding space. But otherwise, it's exactly the same principle. You do this autoregressively with a transformer or whatever architecture of choice that you want. And so the main challenge does not really come from formulating this prediction loss, but it's saying that once you have this loss only, there is a shortcut solution, which is a learning collapsed representation. So if you have this abstract prediction task, what the network will do is say, well, I can just have the first three layers that produce a constant, whatever is the input. And like this, I can always do this autoregressive prediction, right? Because it's always the same constant. So no matter what the past, I know the future is always the same. So I have zero prediction loss. And so the huge research question in JEPA is how to prevent this collapse. So you want to be able to predict in embedding space while still retaining, you know, meaningful, diverse embeddings that capture something about the input. So this is, you know, two terms that try to compete with each other. You want good prediction in embedding space and diversity term or anti-collapse term to prevent collapse.
And size-wise, since you don't have to predict the whole thing, it is also much, much smaller than the autoregressive models, or because since you're training and you have to have this huge abstract latent space, it can be bigger as well.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So you definitely want it to be lower dimensional than the input space. But I would say in practice, for example, if you do video model, you also do it not in pixel space, but let's say, you know, in a VQ VAE embedding space, which is also lower dimensional than the full input space. So I will say the main benefit of JEPA is not really that you can reduce the dimensionality of the embedding, but it's more that you allow to disregard information about the input to simplify the prediction task. So when you will process right through your first three layers, the embedding where you want to do your autoregressive prediction task, those three layers will disregard some things about the input. And so your prediction becomes much less stochastic and much easier. So it's not so much about just the dimensionality. It's also that you allow to pick what you want to predict and what you want to completely disregard from your embedding.
And when it comes to, we've been seeing the evolution of the notion of scaling laws and everything when it comes to the autoregressive models and GPT and so on. Mm-hmm. And we know that there are sort of like limitations as to how much data you can possibly get. And there's, you know, artificial data, synthetic data, mm-hmm. and the compute restraints as well and scales up to a point. What are the sort of technical restraints maybe of world models or even JEPA when it comes to looking ahead as to where that might lead?
Yeah, you know, so first, one thing interesting is that if you look at the quality of your data and you think of having maybe a little bit of noise, which you can consider as something that is useful for none of the tasks, you know, no matter what you want to use your model for, capturing this is useless to get better at, then input space reconstruction or, you know, input space autoregressive modeling will always suffer from wasting compute and time to actually learn the noise distribution. And so you can derive some nice bounds in like simplified models to show that JEPA will be much more sample efficient than input space, you know, regressive model. So of course, this is like, you know, with some assumptions, you need to assume, okay, you know the noise distribution, blah, blah, blah. But there is some nice first result that shows that because you can disregard some features, you can improve your sample efficiency. And I will say beyond this, the main scaling problem right now is how to prevent this collapse. So we don't have a nice recipe where we can scale like language model and produce this nice scaling curve. Because if you multiply the size of the dataset by two or the size of the model by two, it's very, very tricky to just reuse the same JEPA loss per se. Typically, you have to recross-validate a lot of hyperparameters to make it work and so on. So because of this, we don't have yet very nice scaling laws. And that's one of the big limitations as well, because it's very hard, you know, to see, do those things scale as good or not? So that's one of the things we're trying to mitigate with better JEPA objective as well. But yeah, so far, one thing I will say is that what we observe, at least for computer vision and image task, is that the convergence speed is much better for JEPA compared to input space model. And this, again, just comes from the fact that you don't have to model all the stochasticity of the pixel. So with much less flop, much less compute, and typically smaller models, you can get better performance than input space reconstruction. But this is computer vision only. So yeah.
And if you had to bet, talking about JEP or Le JEP as well, the new paper that you wrote, when, in which regimes would they scale best? If, for example, using noisy data or generalization, low label settings, multimodal learning, and why?
Yeah, good question. So I think, Le JEPA specifically, you can think of this as a particular loss to train JEPA that tries to remove a lot of hyperparameters, bring stable training. So it becomes more out of the box to train a JEPA. You don't have this collapse problem as much anymore. But this does not solve all the problem per se. So this, I would say, quote unquote solved, right? Because it's never fully solved. There are still a lot of things we're working on. But this is a step towards making the anti-collapse or diversity term very reliable and easy to debug and understand. But the prediction term is the one that also plays an important role to be robust to noise and, you know, be sample efficient. And this is where we also need to do some research. If, and this you can show it probably, if you have the right prediction term and you use the JEPA anti-collapse term, then you can learn optimal representation in the sense that even if you had supervised label to solve your specific task and you are doing supervised learning, you will not beat the performance of the Le JEPA embeddings. But again, this assumes that you know how to have this prediction task. So for example, it could be Okay, you don't want to just predict the next frame, but the next 5 frame. Or maybe actually you don't want to do it autoregressively, but if you have a sequence of frame, you want to mask a tube within it and predict what the representation of the tube is. So all of those variations are different ways to have the prediction task. And this is what shapes also your embedding space and tells you what type of task you will be good at downstream. So this is the work on the prediction task, and this is where we need a lot of effort to characterize, you know, the relationship between this prediction task versus being good at this downstream task or this other one. And this, we don't solve it yet in LoJEPA because LoJEPA is really just about the anti-collapse diversity term. So we solved the collapse. Now we need to figure out what to predict with our non-collapsed embeddings.
And that's something that you're doing already. This next paper, is it coming out?
Hopefully soon. Yes, we are working on trying to improve LoJEPA to be more sample efficient and trying to really understand what the relationship between the prediction task and the downstream task. So it's still with a lot of assumptions, but we start having some metrics to say, okay, what you should be caring about or not. I would say the exact relationship between prediction and downstream task, this we saw, we did a couple of papers on this already where we were able to show, okay, if you have this right, you know, specification of the prediction task, you can recover supervised learning benchmark. So at least to me, this was already pretty nice because it's sort of a proof of existence to say, okay, if you pick the right hyperparameters within the JEPA family of method, then you can reach this optimum of, you know, supervised learning. So this was already pretty good, even if you have a lot of assumptions on what you know a priori. At least it shows, you know, the JEPA class is not something that will restrict you downstream. It's just about finding the right hyperparameters, basically.
This is just like a futurology exercise I'm going to do with you now. But if you had to guess, like when we're going to have JEPA or whatever comes out of JEPA as a main architecture, would that be in the next 1, 2, 3, or 5 years or more?
Yeah, I think it will depend on the modality. So I think computer vision, so we had Dino already. So Dino is very strong in image computer vision. I will say the pre-training is a bit tricky because you have a lot of hyperparameters, right? So if you use Dino by just downloading the checkpoint, you know, as an end user, it's very easy. If you want to retrain your own Dino, it's a little bit of a pain. And that's why a lot of people switch to LoJEPA instead. So we say computer vision, we are getting there for sure, you know, within less than a year to have something that is stable for pre-training and near SOTA, basically. When it comes to things that is more around text or video, this is a little bit trickier because there are some other questions, for example, for video to include long context. Right now, there is a lot of bottleneck. For example, in VJPA, maybe you have like 16 frames, so you can think of frame skip and so on, but you know, it's very hard-coded. So those are more maybe architecture, engineering, bottlenecks, more than the specific JEPA loss. It will be the same bottleneck you have in supervised learning as well. And I think for language, so yeah, maybe video, I will say maybe more 2, 3 years to also solve those issues as well. And text, I think, is the one where it's a bit harder to know because a lot of the evaluations today are biased toward generative models. So if we don't get better evaluations for language models that are, you know, not just for generative capabilities, it's going to be very hard to evaluate a JEPA solution and to show that it's useful. So it means if we need to come up with new data, new eval protocols, get those guys, you know, accepted, and then come up with a JEPA, this could take a few more years as well. So yeah, this is a bit of more randomness depending on which evals data set and benchmark we get. But yeah, this will be coming for sure, less than 5 years for sure, but not as fast as computer vision.
Cool. But when you talk about this part about text, you working at FAIR, like you have the whole power of compute that Meta has, and you're also related to universities. So isn't, let me put like quote unquote, just a matter of getting a good number of PhD students or postdoc students to work on this with you? Because you have the compute power to do that, no?
Oh, yeah. So I think for sure we need more people working on JEPA generally, not even just for language. I think if you look at the, you know, number of papers published with JEPA in the title or abstract, it must be, you know, a fraction of what is for LLMs and diffusion models. So I think overall, we definitely need more people working on JEPA, no matter what you like, maybe even if it's very applied, like geophysics, astrophysics, medical, you know, no matter, the more people, the more we will make progress. And I think for language specifically, it's not just a matter of, you know, throwing more compute. When it's about thinking about evaluation, it's quite interesting to think, oh, you evaluate a language model that cannot generate text. And it's going to be different benchmarks, and we need to find benchmarks that are relevant for people today. And so that's one of the big things we are thinking about is, do you want to still have a JEPA pre-training for a language model? But then post-training, you learn a decoder, so you can pipe that back into the typical, you know, evaluation pipeline. But if you do this, how can you really show benefit? Because at the end, you still evaluate generative capabilities. So if you pre-train to generate, you can only be, you know, better or as good as JEPA, which is not doing that directly. And so the question is, can you make, you know, still a splash showing that you can recover the same performance with JEPA? So in my opinion, it will be yes. But if you ask, you know, other frontier labs and industries, they're like, okay, if you just match the performance, why do I need to know about this? So I think the challenge is how to find the right eval and application where you can see, okay, now we can do something that pure LLMs are not able to do in next token prediction. And I think another challenge is that those days, if you benchmark against LLM, you really need to benchmark at scale. And so this brings, you know, a whole lot of issues, how to scale and get something out without training for 6 months. So this is also like a big question. So that's why I think computer vision, maybe video, and maybe even time series, but other applications like medical, geophysics, astrophysics is going to be where we see a lot of JEPA coming out first. And then text is going to still benefit from those improvements, but yeah, it will need a few more transformations in the field.
I love it when the conversation sort of goes in the general direction of questions I had already planned, because it shows that the questions were that stupid after all. But I'm still wondering about what is the current best way to evaluate JEPA models or world models and sort of help the general public understand the advantages, because currently most evals are based on the generative models, the traditional ones. So
yeah,
a model, I'm guessing, is sort of like as smart as the way you measure it to be. So it's got to be kind of a difficult thing. Like, what's the best way to evaluate it today?
Yeah, I think it really depends who you speak to. So if you speak to people, for example, doing robotics, then one very nice way we have is to say, okay, after you learn your world model, so you know what the dynamics of the world in this latent space, you can do this model predictive control. So if you tell me, you know, what do you want the robot to be like, I can imagine what's the effect of this sequence of action and try to optimize the sequence of action so that given my current initial state, I can reach this goal. So you can do this planning to do robot arm manipulation, you know, navigation, this type of thing. So for robotics application, this typically goes through showing you can do planning and solve a task. You can do this in an environment or, you know, in the real world as well. I think if you go to other applications, for example, in medical, there's a lot of nice things where you try to understand what's the impact of a drug or a treatment on, let's say, your vital signs or, you know, whatever you observe. So you have this sort of health world model. And if you can show that you have a good predictability by training a probe on top of your latent space, or that your, you know, embedding space is useful to categorize, you know, different categories of, you know, disease or whatever attributes you want in the human that you have in your study, this can also be very valuable. And they have a lot of side data like this to evaluate those models, so this can be nice as well. But I think ultimately what we would like is if you have a completely new data set and you don't really have a lot of ideas about what the underlying physical law governing those, and you train a world model on this, can you post-training figure out, you know, what is the underlying dynamics of the system, and can you derive maybe new physics that explain it? So this will be more of the, you know, physics application, physics side, and this is where maybe you need a bit more of interpretability tools within it to understand what was trained post-training. But this is also something that is very appealing to people working with physics, astrophysics. So I think it really depends on who you speak to. I think for the general public, it's definitely harder to show a compelling use case because it does not generate nice text or does not generate, you know, nice video. So it's not as easy to say, okay, this would be useful in your everyday life to do this task, except if you start having robots at home and then, you know, use those world models to do the planning and execute your task. But this, we're still pretty far from it, right? So I think that's also one of the things we're thinking about is how to have a compelling use case that is as attractive as what you can do with LLMs today.
But in this case, do you think they could work together, like system one, system two kind of thing?
But yeah, there is definitely interaction between the two. So first of all, they could work together in many ways. So if you think about this planning thing, you could use text to specify your goal, for example. So there is interaction with the world models through text, where you can use a lot of LLMs, of course. That's what people already have started showing, or to assemble, you know, VJPA and some Llama models together, for example. But then there could be also a case where maybe you have a world model that on top of which you can learn a decoder LLM to actually probe what it learned, right? So when you want to discover this new physics, for example, that was learned from your data, maybe you can try to do this through text interaction with the user and the embedding. So there will be interactions for sure, because that's the best way for us to interact with things is typically with text or voice, right? So it's going to be a way to interact with the world model. But I think the big question is it something that is added to world models post-training just for, you know, evaluation, interaction, interpretability, probing, or is it something that is part of the world model training itself? So I think this is one question that, yeah, is still not clear.
So, like, for example, if you're using the same example that you use right now, you're trying to discover new physics and you use text or voice or whatever using a classical LLM, it can connect to the embedding somehow of the JEPA model, but the JEPA model is not going to be able to translate in words the answer. So you're going to have to kind of interpret what is giving you back.
Yeah, so you need to do this post-training alignment task, right, where you need to make the language model aware about the world model embedding so that it can figure out, you know, what to probe, what to query, and what to make sense of those embeddings. But it's not something that will be used during the world model pre-training. So you don't want to necessarily use text during the pre-training of the world model. It's more of a diagnosis tool that you have post-training. So this is still an open question, and I guess it will really depend on the modality, the type of data that you have as well, because for this to work, you need the alignment data set, you know, you need paired data, which maybe is very hard to get in some modality. So that's why I think for some case, maybe you don't even have text at all. If you think about, you know, geophysics or even seizure prediction, even if you ask expert surgeon and they see the data, they don't even know, you know, how to describe what they see precisely. It's very dependent on who you ask. So in many cases, it's going to be very hard to find this paired data set. So I think it will really depend on the application. I think that's actually the beauty of world models, is that you don't really need those, you know, experts or teacher or high quality data. You can just get your, let's say, EEG recordings, train your world model on it, gives you very, very nice compressed abstract embeddings. And then you can just process those embeddings to try to do anomaly detection, try to cluster, you know, different groups of individuals, try to predict what's going to happen if you do this treatment or not. And all of this can be done just in embedding space without having to actually, you know, have this language interaction for which you need a lot of paired and expert data. So yeah, this can be a feature or a bug depending on what you want to solve.
And since these two architectures can work together, it doesn't mean that there has to be like this one architecture versus the other architecture to have one be the end all of architecture, right?
Yeah.
So in your view, what kinds of problems are GPT-style ultra-aggressive models still particularly well-suited for and may remain well-suited for even as JEPA-style models evolve?
Yeah, good question. So I think, input space, GPT style, so, you know, LLM style pre-training. If you have very, very nice compressed, you know, low dimensional and clean data, this is still going to be very competitive. So if you think that every bit of information you have in your data, you need to capture it, and it's very, very relevant for a lot of your downstream tasks, then almost by definition, you know, input space GPT is going to be the best thing you can do. There is nothing you need to disregard. You need to capture every detail. So you are good to go. I think the thing becomes, once you have data quality that varies, then you need to either do data curation to go back to this first case, and then input space GPT is going to be still good enough. But then you disregard some data. So it will be up to you to say, okay, is it worth it to disregard some data and have this training? Or do you want to keep all the data and allow to have a JEPA training so that for the noisy data, automatically it will figure out, okay, I need to disregard this part of the data or not. So I think it's going to be a function of data quality, which itself is a function of, you know, which modality you work on, how much you want to pay, what type of data you can get. And so, yeah, this will be the main, and is already the main driver, at least in computer vision. So for example, if you look at a very simple image data set where there is no background, every useful pixel that is activated is useful to do the prediction task. Then reconstruction-based method are pretty much, you know, as good as JEPA. Everything is state of the art, very stable, trained very quickly, very nice. But then as you make the dataset more and more noisy or realistic, so you have a lot of, you know, weird, useless background that is not useful for any task. Maybe you add noise and so on. Then that's where the gap widens between input space GPT versus, you know, latent space JEPA. So this is, one of the main drivers.
Right. Thank you. And sort of a neighboring question to this one. There's this discussion that I'm sure it's even grown stale in the higher circles of AI research, right? Which is the whole thing about autoregressive LLMs, the GPT architecture, and all of the kind of, not a dead end, but kind of it. Like, when you think about the increasing intelligent system compared to world models and their approach, right? Mm. But now that this discussion has sort of like been bleeding over to the mainstream, or at least the mainstream sort of regular users who are interested in what goes on under the hood. Could you sort of explain maybe the misconceptions of what it means, the whole maybe the cat analogy of the LLM not being as smart as this cat, but having word models sort of like is an improvement on that because it tackles the problem from a different direction? Could you sort of like help me try to make sense of this to the listeners?
So I think, I would say the easiest explanation is to say, okay, if you are working in a LLM space, next token prediction, given your input, you will figure out, okay, what's the next token? And then given this new information, you figure out what's the next token and you keep on going, right? You autoregressively produce your answer or whatever is your generative modality. And the problem of this is that it's not really explicitly driven by a long-term goal. So of course, you can argue that maybe implicitly the model learned something so that the next token prediction, you know, use an internal goal and somehow something happened in the model. But there is, even if it happens, and I don't think there is empirical proof of this, but even if it happens, it's something that is implicit and may or may not emerge depending on the data quality, and it's not something you control. So even if it emerged in some case, it's going to be very brittle and maybe hard to reproduce. But in world model, because you have this, you know, known dynamics in latent space, you can figure out what's your plan, your long-term plan, and then backtrack from there what should be your actions or, you know, next step prediction so that you can get close to your goal. And so a typical example is if you want to jump very far, you need to have this goal, and then you can figure out, okay, I first need to go to the edge of the table and then jump and blah, blah, blah. And you can figure out this whole trajectory all in embedding space. And then once you are happy with your plan, you can execute it and solve it. So it's more of an explicit way to have this, you know, long-term reasoning, let's say, or long-term planning, as opposed to what you have in LLM, which is very, very implicit. So maybe it will emerge or not, right? This is another question. But even if it emerges, it's something that will be implicit and very hard to control. And therefore, also, if you want to have safety constraints, for example, it's also very hard because you just hope that, you know, you give enough instructions or enough fine-tuning data so that it starts observing those safety measures. Everything is very implicit. So I think that's a very, very big shift between those two paradigms. And I would say, even beyond that, maybe just going back on the, you know, transformer versus huge foundation model, you know, central AI that does everything. One thing that we were a bit surprised in the JEPA paper is that actually, if you do very, you know, in distribution, specialized JEPA training, you can actually compete and even beat, you know, things like DynoV3, so very, very strong generalist foundation model. And I think this is something also that may shift a bit. I don't know if it will be only in JEPA or JEPA and LLM, but this idea that actually maybe you want more a mixture of very small but very specialized experts that you train in distribution and you almost, you know, explicitly construct versus having a gigantic centralized AI model where you hope that, again, implicitly some specialization, you know, will occur and this will be, you know, much less sample efficient. So I think there will be also some interesting shift in terms of just scaling up everything or just having more in distribution models that are very, very sample efficient and very fast and easy to pre-train. Because if you think about it, even in continual learning, right? Suppose you have a very strong model and now you have new data that comes in from a new distribution. If you have a very, very sample efficient and strong pre-training strategy, which is what you should get from JEPA and not so much from input space GPT. Then you can adapt from those few samples very easily and become good on this new data distribution very easily. So that's why it also matters a lot to have good pre-training strategy and very high sample efficiency, because you can adapt quickly to new data that you never saw before, which is very hard to do with other systems. So yeah, all of this, I think, will slowly, you know, connect to each other and will change a bit what the landscape looks like in a couple of years.
So we are already speaking about JEPA MOE.
yes, exactly. You can frame it like this. Yeah. Hopefully I will try to find a good, you know, eye candy acronym.
That's cool. And I want to go back to another topic. And first of all, thank you a lot, Randall, because you're the main author of a cookbook of self-supervised learning.
It's pretty old now. Some people might say it's obsolete already, you know.
I don't know, but you're an angel for having done this. Like putting all of the recipes in one place is really, really a great work that you have done for the community.
Well, first of all, it's like, I think 20-ish people. So I think all the credit goes to all of them who really did a huge work to bring everyone expertise, but still unify the writing and the style. So it reads as a nice, you know, full cookbook. So yeah, I think this was, I was surprised that, yeah, this was not out before, because you have so many, you know, hidden knowledge that was not written in any paper. So yeah, that was a huge priority to unify all those together and put it out so we can all move forward as a field, you know. I wish there would be more cookbook like this in other fields as well.
I agree completely. And I extend my thank you to all of the people that work with you on the cookbook. But you mentioned that there's something some hidden knowledge that you only realize that is there when you're compiling all of this, organizing all this knowledge. Did this happen to you in some specific case that you're like, oh my God, of course, but only after you are already writing it?
Yeah, I think a lot of the time in a lot of papers, right, you cannot show all the ablations necessarily because sometimes it's things that don't even look interesting to you after you figured them out, right? Because maybe you try something, okay, it does not work, you try, and then you figure out, okay, it's because, you know, those two hyperparameters are coupled, for example. And once you figure that out, you are like, okay, it seems obvious. And so you don't necessarily write this in a conference paper to say, okay, look at this coupling, because a posteriori it seems obvious, right? And so a lot of things are actually not written down just because of you know, this type of thinking, and you cannot gather also all the possible findings you get when you come up with a new method, because then you have like 40 pages appendix, which is not so much useful either, because who has time to read 40 pages on each paper, right? So the problem is that you don't really have a nice medium to sort of communicate, you know, those tips and tricks in a very efficient way and in a centralized way. So that people can learn those and then iterate on those quickly. And so that's what we try to do a bit in the cookbook, where we combine, you know, insights from, you know, pre-training, loss specific, hyperparameter specific, architecture specific, but in a sort of organized way, you know, with those big sections and big groups, so that people can make sense of them. Because I think if you just take one paper which has just one finding, it's also very hard to know, okay, does this extend to another method, or is it only specific to, you know, Dyno or whatever? Like, for example, one typical example is this register token, right? So if you read Dyno, register token is a huge thing that helps a lot. And then you had a lot of follow-up papers that say, okay, let's prove why register tokens is here. And a lot of people say, okay, if you don't have register token, you don't do anything. And then in the JEPA, we tried and we see there is no difference whether there is or there is no register tokens. And so this seems to be maybe more of an artifact of the Dyno loss itself rather than a universal guideline. So I think it's also very hard, you know, within a single method or single paper to give general guidelines, because we don't have enough data points. So that's why also in this cookbook, it was nice to have a lot of people come together so we can say, okay, this paper says that. Is it true for this other method, for this other data set? Yes, no, because that's what is most useful, right? Ideally, we can find the general rules that generalize beyond just one method, basically.
I always get curious when we have interviews with people who came up with new models, new ways of trying to approach problems by the ways that surprised you that people are actually using the models to try to solve problems, right? So can you just pull from memory examples of things that you couldn't have imagined that people are actually using JPL models to solve problems for?
Oh, yeah, I think one very interesting application people showed me recently is in the medical field. So they have access to huge data of, you know, the evolution of, you know, some sensory inputs of your body, basically. And they observe, you know, different treatments that is applied. And so you can do this sort of, I don't know, healthcare or bio, however you want to brand it, world model. And I think it's an application coming from computer vision that seems very, very, very interesting. And I would not have thought of applying it there, you know, out of the box. And it seems to work quite well. So this is also quite quite nice. But yeah, I think medical applications are always the ones that are the most impactful. I think astrophysics is also a very interesting thing. So there is Polymatic in New York that is working on world model for physics. And they are also very, very ambitious goals to discover new physics and do this, you know, latent space modeling of dynamical systems. And the scale, you know, of their ambition is really unparalleled. It's like if you have a world model of the galaxy, you know, and then you can see, okay, what other galaxies will look like under, you know, those different parameters. And also, I think this also goes way beyond what I'm used to, which is, you know, is it a Labrador or or a lion? So, yeah, I think honestly, the more I go to just events and workshops, every time I go back with more amazing applications that people are looking at. And I think this is also very, very nice, right? Because it's very, very early for JEPA research. It's not something that was, you know, out and polished 10 years ago already. And there is not as much, you know, compute and resources as LLM, but we already see people really try it and build on it, because for their data modalities, that's what makes more sense. When you try to, you know, simulate a galaxy and its dynamical system, it's going to be pretty tough to try to do this with LLM. So I think it's very motivating for us also to see that. Yeah, it's very useful in all those applications we did not think about a priori.
I love the idea of a world model being used to simulate a galaxy, right?
Yeah.
Never said it was this world.
Exactly. Yeah, let's do the galaxy directly.
Right. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, no, this is honestly, and it's full of applications like this, which is pretty amazing. Uh-huh. So, yeah.
And after, I don't want to be a downer after this fantastic answer that you just gave us, but
yes, I think that's it. Like, we have to cut now, you know.
Yeah, maybe.
The galaxy, or can we go up from here? You know?
But how do you think about the issue of potential misuse of world models?
Yeah. So I think similarly to language model, if you learn the dynamics of a system and you know, okay, what will be the next state of the system given this intervention and so on, then you can obviously have many different goals and you can see, okay, how to push the system in a way that you want, which maybe is not the best way for, you know, everyone in society. So I think the type of problems are pretty similar to language model in that sense. I would say it's different problematic because we don't deal with language directly. So maybe it's not so much about, you know, semantics and wording, blah, 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 but it's still the same thing that if you know to model a system, you can figure out how to make it worse than it is now. I will say one thing that is going on for JEPA is that if you have some nice safety features when you do your planning, so for example, someone can specify a goal, but suppose the goal they specify is very bad, so break the robot, for example. If you still control the planning procedure, it's very easy to enforce safety measure to say, okay, the speed of the robot should not be more than, you know, 3 miles per hour or whatever. The angle difference in the arm joint should not be more than, you know, 3 degrees. And so you can still enforce safety features at planning time. So that you can prevent, even if they give a malicious goal, those features will prevent you from reaching that goal. And again, because you do this explicitly, not like in a language model where it's just next token prediction, because you do this explicitly, it's actually much easier to do this type of constraint. But again, it's assuming you control the planning procedure. So this means it's not a case where you completely give all the weights and checkpoints to someone, and then they will be able to disable this safety protocol. But at least it gives you this extra lever where you can still let people specify their goals. table and explicitly control what happens during the planning and the generation. So that's still something that not a lot of people are looking at, but yeah, I think it's going to be pretty pretty interesting to see all those safety measures look like.
Right. So semantically, it would know the intention of a potential misuse and would be sort of harder to try to jailbreak it.
So actually, the good thing is that you don't... So that's the other benefit compared to language model. You don't even need to know the intention per se. So if you can include the safety measure just as saying, you know, the car should not go more than 50 miles per hour and the car should never be closer than, you know, 1 meter from a pedestrian or proportionally to the speed, of course, right? So you can still brake. So you can have those very almost semantic-free goals that are almost pure, you know, physics-based, let's say. And this is what will come in at planning time. And then you can enforce this. So even if someone has a goal to actually have the car, you know, hit a pedestrian, because you have those, and you don't have to think, okay, is it bad or not? It's just the physical constraints that you have during planning will prevent you from reaching that goal. And maybe the goal was given a priori by mistake or maliciously, or, you know, whatever other reason, but you don't need to try to interpret the goal and try to, you know, do this sort of guessing game. It's just physical constraints that you can enforce at planning time. So in that sense, it's much easier and maybe even more fair in general than, yeah, what you can do with language model, where you have to figure out, okay, is just trying to, you know, break the system and I should just not answer this question.
That's great. And I want to go back to Marcus's question from before. He asked you, what are the most impressive things that the community have done with using this architecture that you created? Mm-hmm. But I want to ask you something more, I don't know, general. What is the thing that impressed you the most, not about things that you have done, but about the AI community has done in the past, let's say, year or so?
Yeah. So yeah, I think first... most of the things I mentioned before are also not things I did, right? Like modeling Galaxy, I'm still like very far away. I wish I did, but yeah, most likely it's not going to be me. But yeah, I think for the community, the first great thing is that there is a huge optimism and, you know, listening attention for JEPA. And a lot of people are willing to contribute very aggressively to open source model, open source software, open source dataset. And I think this is also something very, very important. A lot of the, you know, software stack has been developed for LLM specifically those days. And so we need a lot of help, even at, you know, software level for JEPA, whether it's pipeline for training, for data evaluation, and so on. And there are huge efforts to push on this, and a lot of groups are doing that. So this is pretty pretty interesting. And also around, you know, thinking about data, giving a lot of open source data to train on, high quality data, a lot of labs throughout, you know, the world basically have released data sets that are very hard to collect, right? You need a lot of students or people to maybe wear glasses or play with a robot to collect data. So this was also a huge time investment. And this is the type of effort that will allow us to move forward. And this is something that language model have out of the box by scrapping, you know, the internet pretty much, but it's much harder to do for a JEPA style model. So this is very, very nice effort. And I think I would say the last thing is that a lot of people now are starting to think about pre-training and JEPA from a theoretical perspective, which is also something that we need because I think you have some nice theory that can be done, but again, almost no one looked at it compared to language model. And so people are taking this turn and trying to see, okay, what can they do in this regime as well. So I would say the adaptivity, you know, the flexibility of the community to switch and consider this alternative, yeah, it's pretty nice.
And going even more general now, like going out of the JEPA world, what is something that any company or anyone has done that you really didn't think that they would do, that they would be able to do, and they managed to do that this last year or so?
Oh yeah, I think, I mean, probably as a general user, I would say the latest capabilities of, you know, generative model, whether it's for image, video, text, I think are very, very impressive if you just want to, you know, create content, which can take many forms, right? It can be on social media. It can be to actually, you know, help you do research, actually. I think the capability of those models have increased a lot, and they help your productivity so much in, you know, managing time, all those redundant tasks that you have to do, you know, when you manage multiple projects and so on. I think this was very, very impressive, all this, you know, scalability. There are still, of course, a lot of things you can find, you know, edge cases, blah, blah, blah. This would probably always be true. But yeah, I think there has been a huge, huge amount of progress in that. I think even in terms of research, you can really get a lot of help with those systems today, whether it's to create figures, to review your code, think about edge cases for, you know, unit tests, maybe help you with the documentation, the whole packaging. So I think we really reach a stage where I can see a good productivity boost. And so, yeah, this, not a lot of people would have expected this would come so quickly, I think. So
cool. And you being there at Meta, at Fear, has your work changed because of what happened in this world of you have always to publish the newest model, the strongest LLM with OpenAI, with Google, with Anthropic? And Meta used to have like the other section, not Fair exactly, but the other department there. You were creating Llama, Llama 3, Llama 4, and now there was the super intelligence labs that came about. So has this changed your job since it happened last year?
Yeah, I don't think it changed a lot, because for a few years now, it's been a huge, you know, pressure and rush to do research. And I would say even in Japan, in SSL, even before you had all those big releases, there was still a lot of competition between labs. It was not as much, you know, in the media, and maybe it was not as much visible. But even when I was just a PhD, there was already this rush that there is this ID, it needs to go out, the field moves quickly. Maybe today we explain something about Relu, and tomorrow, you know, no one uses Relu anymore. So I think this rush was, I'm not that old, right, but at least for the last 10 years was always here in AI research. I think it's just that more it became more visible to the general public. But if you are doing AI research, yeah, it's been 10 years that, you know, you don't sleep for the last week before the deadline, and you are trying to push your research as cleanly and as quickly as possible. So yeah, I don't think there was a big difference on our side. I think, yeah, for the, you know, outsider eye, for sure, it looks very different, and it looks like now it's moving very quickly. But actually, it's been moving very quickly for quite a few years now.
Now, I was wondering that because of something that your former boss, I suppose, Yann LeCun, was saying in an interview, that he was basically saying that when this whole thing came about with the super intelligence labs, there are people trying to tell what the researchers have to research. And quoting him, he said, like, you don't tell research what they have to research. And more than that, you don't tell me as a researcher what I have to research, because of his experience or because of who he is, of course. So that was the reason behind the question.
Oh, yeah. I think for sure that's not something I will be able to say yet, you know. But yeah, I think for sure there is so priorities. And this is true, by the way, at Brown, like, in academia, maybe even more, like priorities and research agenda have shifted a lot, even just because of, you know, the job market landscape. Like, as a student now, almost no matter what they truly care about, they will want to have an LLM paper because it looks like it secures an internship and a job. And I think this is very, very dangerous, because first of all, it removes the diversity of research, which means less exploration. And, you know, unless we believe this is the answer, which most likely it won't be, it's actually very dangerous in the long term. So this is pretty bad. And also it's bad because if you work on something that you are not passionate about, I mean, you can still do great things, but it's not going to be as great and as enjoyable for you. So on many, many points, I think it's actually very dangerous, even more for the academic and student body rather than industry. So hopefully that's why, you know, maybe with JEPA and then other things, we're going to bring some diversification again. But yeah, so it definitely changed those priorities and timelines. And I think that's, yeah, for students, to me, that's the most dangerous things, because it means all the students, when they graduate and get jobs, everyone will think the same. It's always, okay, pre-training, post-training, this is how you scale, this is, you know, how you tokenize. And so this is going to be very, I won't say dangerous, but, you know, not great in the long term. So we need more diversity.
Yeah, I mean, if you had business deciding the direction of research, most of the advancements in the last forever wouldn't have happened. So yeah, I agree completely.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I think this is the most important thing we need to look at.
And Randall, my last question for you is, I'm always curious and ask this, how have you been using AI models, whichever ones you want to quote here or say here, in your day-to-day, be it at work or at your life, being that I don't know how much free time you have to actually have a life aside from the research?
Yeah, good question. So I think most of the time those days I use it for helping me in coding. But the way I use it is more as a, you know, adversarial game. So I try to use it to find maybe bugs in the code or limitation in my unit test, in the documentation, try to improve the code quality. I find it, so I mostly do like PyTorch stuff, right, every day. I don't find it very good at optimizing the code in terms of, you know, time and memory complexity, and oftentimes it hallucinates some functions that are not even in PyTorch, you know. So I think it's more as a extra reviewer that you can use to improve your code. And for figures, this can save a lot of time, right? You don't have to carry around your Matplotlib RC everywhere anymore. So visualization of things already done, and then double checking your code, stress testing your code. This is pretty nice. But I'm still not at the stage where I will let it, you know, review PRs and merge PR on my behalf, because it's still, you know, I don't know, there is still not a good alignment between my style and you know, its style. So I don't trust it yet for this. But yeah, to stress test me, so more as a, you know, adversarial, friendly adversarial game, I think this is pretty nice. And it's also true for the way I write a paper. So I always write a paper and then I say, okay, you know, suppose I review this for ICML, give me three reasons to, you know, reject this paper. And I think this is very interesting to figure out what are the pain points and biases that you have in your own writing and storytelling. And you can use that to improve on your writing. But again, it's a, you know, adversarial style. I will not start from, you know, blank page. I say, okay, write my paper, and then copy paste and iterate on it, because then it's like, I don't know, at least the models I tried are not at that stage yet. But at the adversarial game, I think it's actually pretty nice. So it's not creative in a sense, but it's more as a reviewer. I think this is very useful to improve your code, your writing, your figures, and so on.
And I have a last question as well, if you allow me.
Yeah.
If our listeners, they would like to work with you at Meta, working on JEPA and whatever is going to come out of JEPA, Le JEPA, V JEPA, and all of that. What do you recommend they do? Like, what should they study, and how? What is the path?
Oh yeah, so I think so. The first thing I want to say it. I think your background does not matter whether you care about, you know, writing CUDA, writing C++, doing math, doing theory, solving geophysics problem, astrophysics problem, social problems. There is really room for everyone, because we don't have, you know, anything that is final yet, software, library, paper, theory. So there is really room for everyone. And I will say the easiest is probably to ping me by email, and, you know, we can brainstorm, see if there is a research project already ongoing that is interesting to you. Because honestly, there is really research questions everywhere. It could be some questions that you ask, okay, what is noise, what is signal, or do you, you know, figure that out from your prediction task? Can you guarantee that you actually learned the right signal? You have very high-level questions like this. You have more fundamental things. Like, suppose you have a world model that is pre-trained, or to align a language model on it to, you know, probe it and interact with it, or to enforce those security features during planning. So it can be also during pre-training, during planning, which is more of a post-training application. So honestly, no matter what you care about, what is the data modality you care about, there is for sure a bunch of research projects that will be interesting. So I would say, yeah, just reach out. And this is true, by the way, not just for me. I think the community in JEPA is so small. if you find something interesting, just shoot an email to the authors. Very likely you will get an answer, and very likely they will say, okay, great, that there is someone else excited in the same question as me. So, you know, let's have a Zoom meeting and let's start speaking. Like me at Braun, for example, I think 90% of my collaborators are outside of Braun. You know, I work with people in Europe, in Canada, in South America. So there is really, you know, no constraint, no bottleneck. People just want to move forward, do great research. And so the more, the better. So yeah, just reach out and yeah, that's the best way.
I think that in about 10 years, it will sound unbelievable that you said, no, the JEPA community is rather small. You go like, how was that ever possible?
Maybe this will be like a memory that the AI will show me at the time.
Yeah, totally.
What did you say about me? I cannot write a paper, you know? Let's see.
Randall, thank you so much for your time, for sharing your knowledge with us. If people want to keep up to date with what you're doing at the lab or wherever else, where should they go?
So we have LinkedIn, Twitter/X. We have also a website. So I would say you can just follow me or the lab on those platforms. And hopefully you will also follow, for example, the Google Scholar. You can see our latest paper. But yeah, hopefully we'll find some things interesting. And yeah, again, just ping us, you know, if you have any question, you want to brainstorm, collaborate. Because there is always someone in the team that wants to collaborate, so go for it. Yeah, and thank you for having me. Very happy to speak about JEPA, and thank you for also looking at the cookbook and asking those questions. I think also through this interaction, it's very useful for us to figure out what are the key questions that everyone thinks about, which is not always the same as the one that I think about. So it's useful to debias and, you know, move forward. So yeah, thank you again.
And I heard that there's this link that you would like us to leave in the description.
Yes. So world model. So we have a series of world modeling workshop. The first one was in the Flatiron in New York. So it was mostly world models for neuroscience. So very nice speakers showing all those world models actually may align with the way our brain works. And the latest one was in Montreal a few weeks ago, which was world modeling, a bit more for robotics application. So I will send you the links. All the videos are available on YouTube, free. So if you are interested in those topics, definitely check them out. And there will be actually a third world modeling workshop in Chicago around May. So the date is not final yet. But it will be more world modeling for economics, time series data. So again, there will be a free, Zoom recordings. That's very important. I did not mention it, but yeah, everything we do in the lab is open source. You know, you can see it live for free. You can have recordings. So hopefully we will see you in May in Chicago.
Ah, legal. A gente vai deixar mais esses links também, é claro, na descrição. Obrigado. Mais uma vez, e na descrição também vai ter o link para você que está enrolando, está ficando sem vaga para ir comigo, com o Fabrício, com o Paulo Silveira e com o Marcel Almeida da PM3 lá para o Vale do Silício, na missão Start-se, Alura, Grupo Alum, PM3, Hipsters, Ponto Tech, IA sob controle, para a gente ir lá de 31 de agosto a 4 de setembro. Fabrício, o que mais a gente tem que falar para o pessoal para convencer a galera que não dá mais para perder tempo para poder ir com a gente?
Eu acho que o mais importante é, a gente vai visitar presencialmente todas essas empresas que a gente fala toda semana aqui no IA Sob Controle, seja de entrevistas, seja o de notícias, a gente vai estar lá, dentro desse ambiente, né, conhecendo essas big techs por dentro, falando com pessoas que trabalham lá nessas empresas também. E também que são vagas limitadíssimas, vão ser grupos menores, né? Porque essas empresas não deixam você ir com a torcida do São Paulo, para você, cubista aqui, entrar lá em todo mundo, né? Então tem que ser um grupo mais restrito, com pessoas que estão ali num grupo já acordado com eles. E essas vagas já estão pela metade, tá, galera? Menos da metade, aqui, até eu diria. Então corre lá no link que está aqui na descrição, para você se inscrever e viajar comigo, com o Marcos, com o Paulo e com o Marcel, lá para o Vale do Silício. Marcos, você falou seus nomes aí. O meu apelidinho que eu dou é Imersão IA Sob Controle no Vale. É só assim que eu chamo.
Ok, então vou passar a chamar assim também. É assim que você vai passar a chamar, e não só chamar, dizer, eu fui na imersão. com o pessoal.
Vai ter abadá, eu fui, igual aquele de Porto Seguro.
Excelente. Então o link vai estar aqui na descrição. Pessoal, não percam mais tempo. As vagas estão acabando, o tempo está acabando. Então, para você não deixar para depois e ficar de fora, passa aqui na descrição. E eu e o Fabrício voltaremos na sexta-feira com o nosso resumão das notícias do mundo da inteligência artificial. Até lá!
Este podcast foi produzido pela Alura. Mergulhe em tecnologia. E Faculdade FIAP. Let's Rock the Future. Edição Rede Gigahertz de Podcasts.